components in ways that are similar to those of the accelerator structure. And at the right side here is just an illustration of what one such candidate structure might look like, in which a laser beam or particle beam, shown at right in red, propagates through an ionized gas or plasma, and its radiation pressure, or in the case of a particle beam, discharge force, displaces the electrons, and that creates a essentially periodic structure in the density of the plasma electrons, shown here in the yellow to blue color scale. And that, of course, then corresponds to a structure that has electric field associated with it due to the space charge of these alternating high and low density regions. And that can be used to accelerate a particle bunch shown here in white with gradients of order 10 gigavolts per meter and correspondingly high transverse gradients that can be used for cooling, focusing, and other purposes. So there's been very rapid accelerator progress that I'll talk about today in the last decade that's included generation of high brightness beams, 10 GeV class energy, and combination of multiple stages. And this creates the possibility for future compact collider concepts, both for polarized electron positrons and for gamma-gamma machines, as well as photon sources for applications in medicine and industry that provide important intermediate applications to prove these technologies. So as I said, Accelerator Frontier is concerned both with these, what we would refer to at least in our field as established options, laser and beam-driven plasmas and advanced structures, and also new options that continue to emerge that further push this state of the art. And this is part of ongoing development of these types of concepts. There's an International Committee for Future Accelerators, working group on advanced and novel accelerators. And there's recently been, as we all know, a European planning activity, and that's being followed by a European Laboratory Directors Group planning exercise expert panel, of which Ralph Assman is one of the leads, and he's, of course, one of our co-conveners. So we're tightly coordinated with that, and they'll be generating a report this fall, as Tor mentioned, on Monday. So following the last snowmass, there was development of an advanced accelerator development strategy with the DOE that guides effort towards colliders and near-term applications. So this flowed out of the last snowmass, P5, and then there was an accelerator subpanel of P5 that recommended that strategies be developed to map what was at that time exciting possibilities for these accelerators, but really unknown, I would say, potential for colliders and how we would proceed along that path. So it did that for these three major technologies that I've already mentioned, laser-driven plasma wake fields, or LWFA as it's often called, or LPA, and beam plasma wake fields, or PWFA, as well as wake fields in structures, SWFA. And it turns out that it's possible to generate collider tables, which have a lot of commonality, as I'll touch on in a few slides, for these three technologies. And so that's allowed a fairly coordinated development strategy that mitigates risk. And at the same time, as I mentioned, there are new ideas that continue to emerge from the community that offer even greater future potential performance. That includes laser structures, nanoplasmas, and concepts for shaping the laser pulse, for example, applying focus to mitigate staging needs. So at the right, you see an example of one of these roadmaps from the plasma wake field community. And they're very similar roadmaps for structure wake fields and for laser-driven wake fields. And so right now we're in this R&D phase where we are proofing concepts and doing experiments that prove each of the components of a potential collider. In the PWFA case, they've been constructing a new facility, Facet 2, which will soon begin operation, and that will allow us to do this experimental design and prototyping of elements. And I think the technologies and the R&D to date are at the point where we are now ready to start these sort of integrated design studies for colliders that are sort of outlined at the bottom here. So the idea is that we're developing the components, things like emittance preservation, the ability to efficiently and effectively transfer energy from drive beams, whether laser or electron beams, into plasmas, studies of staging of multiple stages. And then we're also pursuing at the same time near-term applications that will prove the utility of these and which have a lot of commonality with the collider in terms of their requirements. And then that starts to position us for future studies, designs of future studies, and facilities for positron studies, which have already started, and then for studies of potential collider concepts based on these types of systems, which are shown at the top here. So this is just an example of the recent experimental progress since the last snowmass, which has been very rapid. So both LWFA and PWFA have demonstrated high quality multi-GeV beams. And what's shown at the right is an example of an 8-GeV beam from a single 20 centimeter stage using a petawatt laser pulse from LWFA. And there've also been some very nice similar beams from PWFAs. At the same time, there have been proof of principle demonstrations that you can combine multiple stages, taking the beam from one plasma accelerator, refocusing it with high gradient focusing in a plasma lens in centimeters to couple the beam from one plasma structure into another plasma structure, and to use yet another plasma, a plasma mirror, to couple this driver for that second stage, in this case, a laser, into that second stage so that you can combine two modules all at the centimeter scale to preserve high gradients. At the same time, other exciting things have been developed, including the ability to optimize beam loading. This was demonstrated in the PWFA to enable uniform high efficiency acceleration, including transfer efficiencies as high as the 40s of percent with very low energy spread. At the same time, structure wake fields have also made strong progress with demonstration of very high gradients and great potential. This has been complemented by some of these early applications coming online. So FEL lasing has been demonstrated at 27 nanometer by a group in China using LWFA. And there's also been demonstration at Frascati using the PWFA drivers. And these are just a few examples. There's also been strong progress in positron LWFA, hollow channels for low emittance growth, and sources at the 0.1 micron emittance level with a path to nanometer class. So with this progress, the community has also been assessing the limit.
Just 1 second, yes, Cameron. You have about 2 minutes left.
Okay, thank you. The community has also been addressing the limits on this type of technology and showed that shaped bunches can be used to effectively accelerate beams without energy spread growth, that ion motion can mitigate transverse posing instabilities, and that we can do strong plasma focusing to address final focusing and address scattering losses. And these are just a few examples of the other issues that you see listed here. I won't have time to cover them all, but while there are additional technical challenges that continue to require R&D, including the efficiency of staging and the alignment tolerances that are required, it's important to note that it appears at this point that there are not fundamental limits to this technology, and so that really will be limited by wall plug power. And in that context, it's important to note that the short beams that are produced by plasma and advanced structure accelerators do reduce power requirements by putting us into the quantum beam Stirling regime. And I have additional material on that for the discussion section if we want it, while high gradients could enable practical energy recovery. And so all of this indicates that these technologies are capable of 15 TeV level gradients. So we have additional material that we can discuss during the discussion section on beam delivery systems, which can also be based on plasma technologies to deliver comparable compactness. And so coming out of these initial collider studies, we've established that there are collider regimes accessible to all of the advanced accelerator technologies. They're documented in SOMAS LOIs, and they indicate a series of collider options that could be available from the TeV level all the way up through the 15 TeV level, developing a sequence of plasma or structure-based technologies from the structures, the accelerator themselves, to the beam sources, to plasma lenses, and beam delivery for increased compactness and performance as things go on. And it's also important to note that while there's been incredible advances in this field, it continues to be very competitive. There's been huge investment in Europe and Asia, including a recent $500 million class investment in Eupraxia. But the US R&D base continues to create opportunities for our leadership, including in high repetition rate systems and in positron acceleration and in near-term applications. So with that, I'll close and say that I think that all of this indicates that it's appropriate that we engage with the energy frontier on advanced lepton signatures at the 10-15 TeV level for polarized electrons and positrons and for gamma-gammas, and to organize towards an integrated design study based on these elements. To leverage the potential advantages of advanced accelerator systems in short beams and in potential energy recovery, and the potential to reuse facilities of near-term linear colliders like the ILC or like a Fermilab site filler to reach in the future much higher energies, while at the same point possibly having the possibility to deliver high-performance components for other collider concepts. And so we hope to engage with you today on how to do that high energy physics signature studies that will be important to guide accelerator R&D. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cameron. So it was a very interesting talk. I'm sure there will be questions. That's great. That was the idea. Let's proceed with our second presentation by Lian Tao. Lian Tao, can you please share your slides? And you should start. We could not hear you, Lian Tao.
How about now?
Yes, we can hear you now. We see your slides on full screen. Perfect.
Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah, so the goal of my talk is to give you a brief overview of the basic physics case for future colliders. So I'll focus on more general considerations rather than particular proposals. Been using some of the studies, but I've also been using a lot on kind of a order of magnitude estimates and a simple scaling. So I will try to just directly give you the punchlines. And if you wanted to know more, you please ask me, and also have some backup slides. And I will also briefly comment on what are the sort of the bare minimum requirement versus what is needed for a more comprehensive physics program. So the main physics case, I think for a lot of the future collider proposals centers around the two aspects. One is the new physics associated with the electric scale, naturalness considerations, maybe other related new physics, and Higgs self-coupling as well. And the second aspect is dark matter, in particular testing the wind paradigm and perhaps probes into dark sector. Now, this is a very oversimplification of the full physics program. Actual pure physics program can be much richer. And on the other hand, these two basic directions typically frames the basic physics case. Okay, so we have two kinds of colliders, basically, to get to those goals, and a lepton collider. And a photon collider will be similar to a lepton collider, but with somewhat a narrower physics program. I have a few more words to say about it later. And then there's a hadron collider. And there are two kind of approaches. One is try to direct produce the new physics particles and needed for high energy colliders. And the other one is using precision measurement. Okay. So let me begin with the electric weak part. So first, the precision coupling measurement. So this is going after a kind of a deviation, which goes like the electric weak scale square divided by the new physics case square. And LHC can achieve the measurement typically at a few percent. This is probing a new physics scale about the TeV. And now, if we wanted to go up to another order of magnitude to 10 TeV, and this means that usually we need a per mu level of accuracy. So, okay, so please keep that number in mind. And at the lepton colliders in particular, this kind of measurement is usually statistics limited. Okay, so, for example, you can see why, a lot of the proposed Higgs factor is needs 10 to the 6 Higgs, because it's one. The goal is to achieve the per mu level accuracy. Okay. So measuring coupling constant is not the only way to go after this kind of new physics. One can also parameterize the effect of this kind of new physics at higher dimensional operators, and there are other observables you can go after, and these operators will become more important. Their effect will become more important at higher energies. And therefore you don't have to make other precise measurement if you can measure them at higher energy. This means that it's good to measure these, make this some of this measurement at higher energy. So for a lepton collider, typically the reach can be about 10 times the center of mass of the lepton collider. At hadron collider, you know, usually we the actual parton collision energy is much lower than the center of mass energy. But with this measurement, you are still sensitive to new physics on the scale of the actually center of mass energy of the hadron collider. Okay, so this is some examples for Higgs coupling. I don't want to go into details of it, just to tell you that you know, this is a, you know, 10 to, this just show you that 10 to the minus 3 is, or better, even better, is possible. And yeah, so for low energy Higgs factories, they are dominated by CH. High energy, you know, greater than 5 or 600 GeV, is really dominated by WW fusion. So they are actually sensitive to somewhat different couplings. And the measurement at the lepton collider tends to be more model independent, such as WIS measurement, CWIS, and so on. I should also mention that this is a Higgs coupling, but if we also have a Terra Z factory with also some option of scanning the TT bar threshold, it can also improve significantly other electroweak precision measurements. And Higgs self-coupling is another important question associated, for example, with the electroweak phase transition and so on. And a typical benchmark is that we wanted to eventually achieve a few percent measurement for the Higgs triple Higgs coupling. And this is typically need a TeV lepton collider or 100 TeV PP collider, for example. Okay. So, and we can also go after the search for those new physics particles direct production that may have something to do with the electroweak scale. This is a typical example of SUSY stop. And for other, you know, top partners, the reach is similar. So hadron collider's reach is typically about 10% of its central mass energy, right? So, and for lepton collider, one can hope to go to the kinematical threshold, which is half of the central mass energy. And the photon collider will be similar, but it can only produce, keep in mind that they can only produce charged particles. So, all right. So you can ask, what is the scale we are aiming for? Okay, so you know, and one of those arguments is fine tuning. Basically, you're comparing with the Higgs, you're comparing Higgs mass with the new physics mass scale, maybe multiplied by a loop factor. If this ratio is small, this means that this model tends to predict a much heavier Higgs mass. And then we measure, that means not so good. And so what is the new physics scale to aim at, right? So, I mean, this is, I will have to say that this is only a theoretical expectation, what I just said, although it's an extremely well-motivated one. However, it's not a firm prediction. If you really wanted to get some kind of measure in your mind, it's, you know, maybe, you know, this is a semi-empirical statement is that the number of good theory ideas that's still left perhaps is the percentage of it is the same as this small number. Okay, so the currently I think we are proving the new physics scale at around the TeV, and therefore the fine tuning is about a few to 10%, and this means that of all the ideas only a few or 10% will perhaps survive, and this is uncomfortable, I would say. And the next milestone, therefore, is the tens of TeV, which pushed the fine tuning down to less than 10 to the minus 3. I think in many people's mind that this is a much more definitive test. Okay. Next topic I wanted to mention is dark matter. So this is just some very simple, that's perhaps the simplest WIMP model. And it's very predictive. All the interactions is fixed by the standard model weak electroweak gauge interactions. They have a very definitive prediction about what the mass of those particles are. They are all in the range of TeVs. And it's out of reach for the LHC. It's very difficult for direct detection as well. And so for lepton collider, and you know, given high luminosity, and the lepton collider can probe this kind of dark matter almost close to half of the central mass energy. For hadron collider, this is also it can be actually quite difficult. So will be only a few percent of central mass energy. It's just based on some simple scaling by looking at these reaches. So perhaps therefore we need for hadron collider we need really 100 TeV ish to get to test these models. Where for lepton collider we need tens of TeV lepton collectors to actually test these models. And you know, these future colliders also give us a good window to look into dark sectors through these kind of top portal couplings. For example, Higgs can decay into, can have couplings to some dark sector. Also, Z boson can decay into dark sector. And these are, you know, promising ways of probing the dark sector. And the sensitivity to these kind of things are exactly proportional to the number of Higgs or Z bosons that can be produced. So if we want to have a benchmark, we can do some very rough estimate. You know, if the Higgs, for example, interaction with the dark sector is actually mediated by some tens of TeV, again, this 10 TeV number, new physics. And very roughly, the branching ratio Higgs to dark sector can be, you know, less than 1% to 10 to the minus 3. So Higgs factory, because it tends to produce 10 to the 6 Higgs bosons, in principle, the sensitivity could be as good as 10 to the minus 5. Hadron collider actually produce much more Higgses, but its reach is somewhat more depends on the decay product, because hadron collider will have more background. It's hard to make a model independent statement. Yeah, like you can do a similar estimate for Z to dark sector, and you know, Terra Z in principle can have a sensitivity, a great sensitivity into probing these dark sectors. Okay. So the last thing I wanted to comment on is some consideration of luminosity. So first, the hadron collider. So this is you know, just basically the estimating the gain in terms of the reach of the mass of new physics compared with a three inverse Adelbart Hagumi LHC. So the vertical axis is the ratio of the gain, and so the horizontal axis is some time, and there are the various curves are run plans with just some toy number run plans that with various luminosities. You know, the first feature you should see is that there is a very fast gain at the beginning. That's, you know, a distinct feature of all the hadron colliders. This means that you don't really need a lot of luminosity to achieve a big step already. All right. So in terms of numbers, so I think 10 to the 34 even seems to be already doing a reasonable job for 100 TeV. So much higher luminosity of course needed for additional measurements such as Higgs self-coupling, where if you wanted to go to a higher energy hadron collider, maybe 10 to the 35 or even 10 to the 36 will be, you know, needed to really match the gain. And for lepton collider scenarios, it's a little bit easier to define because the signal there is cleaner. So one can imagine that there is a possible minimum scenario in the sense that if the new physics signal is so distinct that we don't really have to produce that many of them to discover them. So maybe a basic requirement could be just, I will produce order 10 new physics signals. And this will certainly miss some other important physics, but perhaps maybe a good starting point if we have that kind of machine. Of course, the optimal scenario will be, you know, we can cover really difficult cases such as dark matter searches and so on. Okay, so this is just another indicative plot for these two scenarios with various energy of lepton colliders. I took the cross-section to be around electric weak cross-section, and the bands is that I'm just varying the cross-section by a factor of 10. And you see that the luminosity still scales with the central mass square, but the sort of the minimal scenario is only requires about 10 to the minus 4 of the luminosity needed for a more optimal scenario. Okay, so I think that's all I wanted to say. So this is just I try to fit all the punchlines in one page, and I won't read it to you. So just, this is just for your reference. Thank you.
And thank you very much for very nice overview, these nice plots. Again, I scribbled a few questions here, so, but I will wait until we hear for the next presentation. And look, why not me? Yeah, so just do, yeah, good. So let's move now to Thomas Roser presentation. So Thomas was asked by his accelerator for Frontier Conveners to lead the accelerator implementation task force, and he will be talking about what this task force is about and what their current status and plans. So Thomas, please.
Okay, I think you can hear me now.
Yes, we can.
Okay, sorry. Okay, so as Dimitri said, I'm gonna give you a status report on this, what the implementation task force has been doing. It was created by the Accelerator Frontier conveners earlier this year, and with the goal to look at the question is, what are the time and cost scales of the R&D and associate test facilities, as well as the time and cost scales of a future collider facility. In fact, early on, we decided to limit our task to collider facilities only. What you see on this slide is pictures of the task force members. We have increased the membership by a few people recently, that includes two more junior members, Marlene and Spencer, as well as Sarah Cousineau, to get a more diverse and a more complete view from the community. So there are clearly a number of possible projects, and they have already been listed and by the previous speakers, mainly. One option that was actually has not been mentioned earlier, but was brought up over the last year, is an ERLMA option, which focuses particularly on a more energy efficient version of such a large collider facility. What the task is of this task force is mainly to do comparisons of the various parameters of these facilities, which includes also cost, although that's always a very difficult thing to do, but also schedule, also not easy, as well as R&D. The first thing we did was develop metrics that we then send out to the proponents and ask them to submit filled out spreadsheets along with those metrics, and that has happened. So I went through the charge items mainly already. So we are I think step three, or at least step two. We have contacted all the proponents. We have collected those spreadsheets, and we have started to work with some proponents to refine those submissions. And let me see. Yeah, finally, what our goal, of course, is to document all of this, both the metrics, the processes, and the conclusions at the summer Snowmass meeting, which is now next year, in form of a white paper. We have, in fact, not taken a pause. We have continued our work throughout the pause of the Snowmass effort. As I mentioned already, we're focusing on collider facilities. We have developed the metrics and collected a total of 21 spreadsheets so far. And we have started to form subcommittees or subgroups to address these four topics. Namely, one is on size, complexity, power consumption, and environmental impact. The next is on physics reach or physics impact. And we just heard Valen Tao, what are some of those ways of how to do that. But this is going to be quite difficult, and we need to work together with particularly the energy frontier convenience on this. Another subgroup is on technical risk, technical readiness, and validation projects, and finally a cost and schedule subgroup. So this is underway. We will also categorize the proposals that we are receiving into four categories. The first one is existing facilities, so we don't receive any proposals for that, but we selected the LHC and XFEL as a reference project to basically guide the proponents on how to fill out those spreadsheets. Then proposals that have a TDR and or a CDR already, these are pretty advanced proposals. The third category is proposals that don't have a TDR or a CDR, but are reasonably well thought through and are mostly based on existing technologies. So there isn't like an unproven technology that still needs to be developed as part of that proposal. An estimate of component counts is also would exist in that case. And then the fourth category is future concepts and ideas that are more speculative. Presently, we have a tentative schedule to produce a draft report by the end of this year, which we then can share with the proponents, the AF and the EF groups for feedback. And then looking at maybe a final report by March. And then, of course, we have the discussions. That report will be in the form of a white paper. And then we have the discussions next summer. So just as an example, since our main task is really comparing the various proposals, as an example, I'm showing a spreadsheet where we started to list all the submitted proposals in terms of various parameters, beam energy or center of mass energy, of course. In this case also for this particular spreadsheet focuses on power consumption. So this is estimated site power consumption shown in this column. Beam power, and then we can look at ratios. And then finally, of course, luminosity. And you can see here, luminosity varies greatly, of course. And as expected, it drops rather quickly as you go up in energy. And then finally, the major figure of merit then is how much luminosity can be produced in this case. Per site power, for example, or at for beam energy. We need to think of how to fold energy into this figure of merit as well to make that maybe a little more relevant. But what you can see in this table already is that in this last column, there are large variations by a couple orders of magnitude for various concepts in terms of luminosity that can be achieved for a certain amount of site power energy consumption. Anywhere from, you can see in this areas here, it's generally like 10 to the 32 per megawatt. Whereas you can get in for these concepts, it's more like 10 to the 34. Per megawatt of site power. So this slide shows linear collider proposals as well as circular collider proposals for E plus E minus colliders. On this slide, I'm showing first PP colliders, hadron colliders, various as well as a more speculative concept, and then Wakefield colliders, and then muon colliders are shown here. You can again see that for any of these concepts, none of them can reach 10 to the 34 per megawatt. So again, this parameter varies greatly for the various concepts. And then just for completeness, I just want to show the various proposals that we have received together with the person of point of contact as well. So these are the Higgs factory concept and proposals. And these are the high energy concepts and proposals, both E plus C minus, as well as hadron colliders and muon colliders, as well as Wakefield colliders. So finally, my summary is that, as mentioned, our task force has continued its work during the pause. The parameter spreadsheets were collected for major proposals of future colliders. But I want to say that we are still accepting additional proposals, as well as updates to proposals that have been submitted over the next couple of months. I think with the restart of SNOMAS, this is appropriate that we are open to collect more proposals. And as I mentioned, tentative schedule is to have a draft report by the end of this year. Thank you.
Thomas, thank you very much for this very nice presentation. Even under time, I think it's provided a lot of useful information. So now with the talks over, but speakers available, it's time to ask questions. So as we discussed, if you could please raise your hand in Zoom, so we will sort of guide the discussion. While you're thinking on your question, let me start maybe from one question to Thomas. So because you mentioned that, look, you are still welcoming proposals, and one of the talks yesterday, for example, was about Fermilab site fillers, which I did not see in your table. So maybe it would be useful to set well-defined deadline until what time proposals could be submitted, otherwise there might be a mismatch.
Right, so I said that—
Whatever it is, yeah, December 1st or January 1st.
December 1st sounds like a good time, because we wanna aim for a draft report by the end of the year. And so we need some time to include new proposals.
Okay. Look, I think it has to be communicated to as many in the SNOMAS community as possible, just that there is no sort of complaints when someone will say, oh, I thought I can do it next year.
Right.
Okay. Yes. Good.
But formally, all these, six or seven site fillers options, which Pushpa presented yesterday, they were not submitted to ITF because we work what we got so far, right? So they need to be either communicated somehow or what, right? I don't know. Yeah, somehow this parameter list should be formulated properly and sent to the ITF. I believe that's a kind of homework for Pushpa and the proponents of these site filler options. Right.
Okay. Right. Yeah. No. I mean, we have the spreadsheet, a well-defined spreadsheet, and I think all that's needed is to fill this in for these new options, and also I've asked the other proponents as well to submit a short description of the proposal as well. Right.
Very good. Thank you. Thomas, I think that's a good introduction that I can see that Pushpa has actually her hand up here. So Pushpa?
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to mention that the PP collider site filler, we had actually submitted an LOI. I mean, we had an LOI which kind of covered several options, including the muon collider, Fermilab site ones. I don't think we had the circular E plus E minus, I'm not sure. I don't know how these machines were picked to go into the table or to request the proponents for parameters. Vladimir said that we picked the ones that were proposed, but So the site filler PP was actually proposed. So I'm not sure why it was left out, Vladimir.
Right. Well, I can answer that.
Maybe it was hidden in the law and you didn't pick up, although Frank had actually picked it up and showed last year at the community planning meeting. But, you know, just mentioning that, we would be happy to provide the parameters for the ones that we think. Thank you.
Good. The selection of those proposals was done by the various AF groups, right? And they picked and they forwarded it to us. So, but it's open. So
yeah, thanks, Thomas. Thank you.
Very good. Pushpa, anything else on the site?
No, I think that's fine. Yeah.
Thanks. Very good. So, Sridhar.
Yeah, I don't see Emilio connected, but he did say yesterday that they have an early draft available for those who want to look at for the CQ, which may have what you need to get something. Actually, Michael is there, bro, so he can talk about it.
Yes, I think for the purpose of this meeting, I think we'll make contact with Thomas about what spreadsheet should be filled in for this new design, and that would be updates of some of the things that he already has. So we will get on it and hopefully we'll get you that soon.
Very good. Look, I'm glad that we now know when and where and whom to contact. And I'm really pleased to hear from Thomas. Look, it's an open process. Whoever has an idea should feel free to submit, and Thomas and his team will add to the list.
And to be noted here that Cameron mentioned in his slides that the site fillers options for advanced linear colliders could be considered as well. But so far, I believe nobody even talked to you guys, to AF6 guys about that, right, Cameron?
That's right. I mean, I think that given the stage of R&D on advanced accelerator concepts, I think that the geometric gradients indicate that advanced accelerator concepts could be used to upgrade a future Fermilab site filler in a similar way that they could be used to upgrade ILC. My personal view is that we probably don't have to generate additional lines in the table for that, because we have lines in the table for 1, 3, 15 TeV, and we can assess with the Fermilab folks, and I would love to do that, which of those could fit in as a potential upgrade, for future Fermilab site filler. I think that would be a very productive thing to do.
Okay. Very good.
I have a question for Lin Tao and Thomas, actually, because Lin Tao showed that the kind of useful luminosity range is enormously broad. He mentioned like 4 orders of magnitude for at least for lepton colliders as something we can still chew on, right, and consider as reasonably interesting. I just wonder how we're going to judge then various collider options, because so far there was an enormous push for luminosities to be as close to this famous formula. I believe Lin Tao showed it, what is the optimal luminosity formula, right, proportional to S. And now we hear that 10 minus 4, that's 0.01% of that, is still okay. So you open can of worms, because you just heard that we expanded number of options to consider to site fillers, maybe low luminosity site fillers, and so on and so forth. So how should we consider that that statement? How will you judge colliders if they deliver the same energy but spread of luminosity?
I think that the bare bones.
We ask everyone to mute who are not talking, because thank you.
The minimum thing is really minimal. I mean, I think I just take the simple electro weak production cross section. Just ask for I can produce 10 of them at near the kinematical threshold. So. I mean, it is useful. I think it was setting some interesting, limit or discover some new particles if it's there. And on the other hand, it shouldn't be the end point. I think it's good to have as the beginning point. Okay, that I hope I made myself clear that Yeah. So that's the my definition of my minimum scenario.
In that sense, basically the entrance ticket is your minimal luminosity, which you consider as at the beginning. But of course, all collider proponents are asked to kind of say something about ultimate possibilities as we see them, something reasonable, or reasonably achievable after some effort or something like that.
Yeah. And hopefully it will be ramping up. Okay.
Eric?
That gives a good path for the accelerator folks, I think, because we can, have a minimum luminosity that will start to produce some events and then a path towards your optimal. Very helpful. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to agree with that statement. This isn't something that I had realized, that the minimum buy-in for the luminosity was four orders of magnitude lower than the optimal. And I think that opens up a lot of possibilities, like everyone's been saying, because we can now consider staged approaches where we target the high energy, say 10 TeV, but the initial realization would be a lower luminosity machine. And as long as there's a viable upgrade path to high luminosity, I think that really makes our job much more appealing in terms of delivering a machine that's useful for high energy physics, especially all these concepts based on plasmas and advanced structures. So I think it gives us a lot to think about now. What is the optimal path for a proposal in terms of economics, cost savings? This is new information for me.
May I comment on Eric's comment, Eric, about viable path to higher luminosity? Yesterday, Steiner Stapnes was talking about clique luminosity updates possible. And I think quite encouraging to me was to hear that for 5% of the total cost, increase, they can increase luminosity by factor of two by going to factor of two higher rep rate. For example, it's a very simple in terms of technical realization, of course, costly, but not enormously costly. I think 5% cost of factor of two increase in luminosity might be used as a standard. I think it's extremely encouraging news in some sense. That some collider options allow such enormously high luminosity increase for relatively little money. Maybe all advanced projects should be kind of considered what they can do and for how much. Yeah. I'm afraid that you guys are also talking about high rep rates, but it's not factor of two higher rep rate, but enormously larger repetition rates to get to high and higher beam energies and beam powers. Oh, sorry, beam powers and and luminosities. Correct, right? That's how you get to high luminosity.
So I guess it depends on where your baseline is. Certainly, relative to where we are right now, the repetition rates for a machine at 10 to the 34 or 10 to the 35 are much higher than where we are right now.
Yep.
But I think that if you're looking at a similar increment to the one that Click talked about, then it would essentially be a twofold increase in repetition rate, or you would be scaling emittance or some other parameter. So as Eric said, I think it does open up some design space if you can start at a fraction of that luminosity but at full energy, and then progress in a combination of repetition rate, emittance, focusing, and other parameters. I think it does make a facility realistic on a shorter time scale.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted Thomas. Thomas, please go ahead.
I want to comment on that because, as I mentioned to my talk, we're going to be looking at some form of a figure of merit, like luminosity per power, but also luminosity per dollar, right? And which I think are the important very important figure of merits to be considered by Snowmass. And I would hope that the proponents keep that in mind, right? And if they can have a proposal that has a better luminosity per dollars, then that's what they should propose, right? And so I think that it should for us be this, from the task force, should be the assumption that what is proposed is optimized according to these figure of merits. right? So it's not just luminosity, it's energy has to be included as well, of course. And that's a little more difficult, but still.
And Thomas.
Patrick. Hi, thanks. I just want to make a quick comment on, this range of luminosities. And obviously when you have a range, that's a good possibility. So you could start in lower and go higher. But I'm sure Lee and Tao would agree that this is a very rough estimate based on thinking of very specific physics sorts of models that you're thinking about. In the sense of trying to get the full mass range and if there's a particular particle right there at half the center of mass energy. I think at the same time, we should also think about, for instance, one of the big targets that we know is there in terms of Higgs physics and trying to understand the potential for the Higgs potential is understanding, for instance, the cubic and the quartic couplings of the Higgs. And for instance, Lee and Tao had a slide and he has like a percent level or something like that. But there's lots of models that have been developed in the last 8 years or so where even if you kind of follow your nose and take the only couplings that we know about for scalars like the Higgs, where that number could be 10 to the minus 3 is the natural shift in the triple Higgs, not 1%. And I have no idea of how to get there, but at the same time, in terms of optimizing luminosity, only about finding a particle with weak interactions that's at half the center of mass, that worries me a little bit in terms of the one definite return we have is the Higgs and trying to exploit how much we can learn about that.
Yeah, I think I agree, for these very, it really depends on what the goal is, right? So I think if we wanted to, I'm trying to, if there is a starting point, if luminosity does cost a lot, if there is a starting point, at this sort of minimum luminosities, we can still do something. We can do top partner searches, perhaps. We can do, it's some of the things that we really care about. Of course, as I said, the ultimate goal should be go up to these, optimal luminosities even better, I think, to achieve the full physics potential. Yeah, I just don't want to say that, you have to start out like right there, otherwise we do nothing, right? So there is this, a much lower starting point where I think in a few years we still learn something. We're still much better, learn something we don't learn, from Hadron Collider, from LHC, and so we still go way beyond LHC.
Yeah, sure. I just want to make sure to bring up that devil's advocate point that I think Michael Peskin brought up maybe on the first day or so. That in terms of laying out the theory case for all these, it can't just be about, we want to look for the parameter space that's a little bit further away. We want to think of what are the ideas, what have we learned, and where does that possibly point us?
I think Michael has his hands raised, and then after him, Patrick Mogley. Okay,
Michael. Just continuing this discussion, circa the previous SNOMAS, the Muon Collider group thought about the question, what is the minimum energy for, let's say, a 10 TeV muon collider? The thing that they emphasized were narrow resonances. So a Z-like resonance that you could sit on with much lower luminosity. Maybe it would be good if a few of us theorists got together a short paper about this question. What is the minimum luminosity and what are the breakpoints for any collider at, let's say, 10 to 20 TeV. It would be an interesting exercise and maybe it would be useful to you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, I agree. I think it would be very useful looking on various options and that in many cases, even for sort of better developed options, cost is substantially driven by luminosity.
Yeah.
So right. I think—
But of course, I agree with what Leon Tao and Patrick said. Mm-hmm. The goal of this 10 to the 35, 10 to the 36 luminosity is really what you need to do the physics. And these things are exceptions, but it's a place to start.
Correct. And if you look on the luminosity of some machines, well, at least Hadron machines, you see that look, sometime you can increase them by orders of magnitude over a period of time. But that's an option.
Patrick?
Yeah, it's just I think we all agree that it's better to be rich and healthy than poor and sick. So, of course, I guess we physicists would like to have, you know, everything, the butter and the money for the butter. But I think it's important to keep all those options on the table, because at the end, the choice may not be made by physicists, and there might be some limits in the cost or something like that, which would naturally exclude some of those gold-plated options that are mentioned. So I think it's really important to keep this table as broad as possible, so that when the moment of choice comes, there are options to choose from. So I think it's a very good exercise what was shown by Thomas, for example.
It's actually interesting that I believe Thomas has a subgroup in his implementation task force, which is supposed to, not precisely, but roughly judge physics potential for, at least for the parameters of the machines given, kind of given energy, given luminosity, given type of particles. I understand it will not be as comprehensive as our theory colleagues can do, but I just wonder whether Thomas, your subgroup members, do they talk to theory frontiers, to like Liang Tao and others, or do you plan to talk to them?
Absolutely. We started to meet with Liang Tao already, and he already provided a lot of information to that. In fact, I think it should be really led by the theorists, right?
Because I think that's what Patrick is asking, that all the options should be kept on the table. And I believe your implementation task force, for example, is not going to provide final answers or priority or anything like that, but instead of indicate in a very soft scheme, like a color scheme or something, kind of a current attitude toward this option or that option or something like that. So in that case, all options will be kept on the table, but will be slightly colored. That's my understanding. Is it what we're shooting for?
Absolutely. And I think, the physics impact, I don't see as where we could make too much contribution, except for make sure that the input is correct, right? Mm-hmm. That goes into SNOMAS. I really think that we can make a contribution in terms of the cost figure of merit, the power figure of merit, and the required R&D and technical risk. I think these are areas where we can make a contribution.
Okay. Emanuel and then Sergo.
Yes, I don't want to sound too naive, and I just joined the discussion, but in reference to what Patrick Magli just said, isn't it true that at the last 2013 SNOMAS, what played a major role in establishing the next US HEP vision was the money that was available, right? Because I remember that there was a big push for the Muon Collider already at that time and other options. And also in those times, I seem to remember that this community also was trying to keep, you know, as many reasonable options on the table, but nothing beat the financial limitations. So how are we going to overcome this huge obstacle this time around? Is there any way that it can be overcome?
Let me probably try to answer, Emanuel. So first, I would say we should probably well separate the roles of SNOMAS and P5, which is expected to follow. So of course, SNOMAS is not making any financial decisions or any project. That's exactly what prioritization panel needs for P5, which has to sort of get information like table from Thomas task force, digest, look on the funding availability, other numbers, and look somehow come with some decisions. And that's what they did back in 2013, like we or not these decisions, but they did that. So in my view, SNOMAS is, and what we should be doing is proposing as many various options, well thought options, of course, that people can understand them and rely on the numbers provided to choose from. And then we will sort of work with P5. I'm sure they will also have some meetings, discussions with proponents. but that's sort of probably a generic answer, but that's how the process worked and is expected to work this time as well.
But to add to what Mitch said, Emmanuel, I believe Thomas mentioned several times that the cost figure of merit for different machines is different. So, and will be at least independently judged by his task force. And that might be an input for future thinking, whatever, P5 committee or community, or it will be something to even to criticize, because I don't think that Thomas will provide the final answer. And I totally agree with you that cost is extremely important. Again, my own analysis shown that the probability of anything to be built, anything expensive to be built, is inversely proportional to cost squared. So if the probability of your machine to be built is 1% and you reduce the cost by a factor of 2, you gain immediately and you get 4% probability instead of 1%. So that's extremely, extremely important, of course, to look into the cost numbers and the cost merit factors. Sergo.
Thanks. I may say something obvious, but I wanted to go back for a second to the luminosity arguments. So of course we can debate about where new physics may lie, but I think it's very difficult to predict nature and to say that the new particles will appear at this energy or that energy. And so it's hard to predict that we'll find pair production of, let's say, new scalars at a certain mass. And, you know, we've been seeing, for example, at the LHC that the expectations were that we'll find, for example, strong SUSY, and so far it didn't happen. But we certainly have very powerful tools in front of us, right? I think Nantao laid it out. I mean, one of the things is dark matter, but the other thing, for example, is Higgs, and many believe that Higgs is the portal to new physics. And so exploring the Higgs is a big thing. So what I'm trying to say is, for the machine that we build, there should be certainly luminosity targets that would allow us to say to advance our knowledge of the Higgs substantially with respect to what high luminosity LHC can provide, right? And if you look at the projections that were made so far for E plus and minus machines, you will see that you need luminosity in order to really substantially supersede high luminosity LHC projections. Now you can argue, of course, whether high luminosity LHC projections are achievable. I think history shows us that we tend to do better than what we project. So if you believe that, then I think we should be mindful of the luminosity. Of course, having an upgrade path is certainly a good thing, but even the minimum targets have to bring some not very narrow physics gains. I wanted to say that some unique measurements that substantially advance our knowledge, that being, if you wish, couplings with quartic or trilinear or quartic couplings, you name it. But that's just my point that I wanted to raise.
Thank you, Sergo. So
I think it's a good point. Yeah, so Cameron.
Great, thanks. So I think the luminosity discussion is a very important one. And another discussion that I think that is important to have is the distinctions between different leptons or lepton-like particles. So there have been, I would say, probably the most calculations for muon colliders at high energies, because I think they're the most developed cases there. So if I understand Lian Tao's presentation, I think to a large extent, leptons are leptons from what I understand. So electron, positron, muons, similar signatures if we can deliver the luminosity of the IP. So that's one point I'd like to draw out with you all. He touched briefly on gamma-gamma, which had similar energy reach in some of the signatures, but only accesses a subset of the channels. So that's another option that's on the table. And then a third axis that's interesting to probe is that some of the collider options for leptons or gamma-gamma are capable of polarization. Others are not. And so how important is that? And so these are things that I hope we can communicate in this SNOMAS report. We need to do calculations with the energy and theory frontiers. And that's one of the things I hope can come out of the discussions today is how do we plan for that?
Yeah, it would be nice to hear from our energy frontier guys and theory guys. Cameron several times already, Cameron and his colleagues in AFO several times already brought up that what we see from our point of view, from Accelerator Frontier, is that there are a lot of analysis, calculations, and discussions go into the understanding and mu collisions at all energies. While electron-positron colliders, multi-TV, for example, advanced ones, have their own, you know, features, like a beamstrahlung, and the rep rate is different, everything is different. And so far, I believe the only, say, input which we provide and really gets useful is energy and luminosity. We are telling them two numbers, and nobody's asked for any other details. So do you guys care about so how we deliver this beam? So for example, if beam strahlung becomes 100%, that's a real threat for extremely high energy linear colliders, E plus E minus colliders. How will you extract physics, and or what are the, you know, figure of merit factors for you know, E plus E minus machines compared to say heavy leptons like muon machines? Would be nice to have some either rough estimates or rule of thumb, you know, laws of how to compare things. Same for gamma gammas. On one hand, we hear from Michael Peskin, at least like a couple months ago, there was discussion that gamma gamma is not that bad. On the other hand, you know, seem that nobody's talking about that seriously anywhere. Why is that? So why Energy Frontier folks do not ask us questions about E plus E minus multi TV or gamma gammas of all kinds?
Well, I think I don't know. I mean, maybe others can comment as well. I think it's just the perception that the E plus E minus cannot really go to that high energy. I've never seen a proposal that will go to like 10, 15 TeV from E plus E minus. And, you know, I mean, also at that energy, as far as I think new physics probe is concerned, E plus E minus is very similar to mu plus mu minus. The major difference between E plus E minus and mu plus mu minus is at the 125. Okay, that is, anyway, I think this is a very broad brush picture. So photon, okay. I think I already said, photon has a somewhat narrower physics program.
But you see the energy spread, for example, take 10 TeV muon collider and 10 TeV advanced linear collider. So the difference will be that muon collider has 10 to minus 3 energy spread, and the electron positron collider will have 50% energy spread in the center of mass energy spread. Does it matter for you guys? But they potentially have polarization. Yeah. I'm still not sure about that. But
I think in terms of energy spread, and as far as the new physics search is concerned, it doesn't matter that much, okay? Mm-hmm. I think in one place I know energy spread matters a lot is, you know, at the Z factory. You wanted to, you know, measure the Z mass and width and so on. Right? So, but at very high energies, I probably don't really matter. It does matter to some extent, of course.
You see. Yeah. We have Patrick's hand, yeah, who's theorist with.
Well, yeah, I just want to add on to that. I think. At some level, a lot of these studies haven't been done for thinking about what are the novel things that you could do at 10 TeV with a lepton collider in terms of really exploiting a lot of the precision of it. So a zeroth order thing is, I mean, if you tell us what parameters and how they really differ by order of magnitudes, we can start playing with that. But another thing also is kind of playing this cost game. I mean, I know, like I brought up, for instance, when we talk about like Higgs precision at like click versus 10 TeV muon, blah, 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 that the numbers in terms of just the cross sections are very similar for like a 10 TeV muon collider and click at 3 TeV that's polarized. Now, again, I have, as a theorist, I can always calculate the cross section for you, but in terms of what's a cost saving of terms of making the thing polarized versus giving me the energy, et cetera, I mean, that's the part that we need the feedback mechanism. But we can answer all these questions if you're willing to tell me where there are large qualitative differences.
Okay, Manuela.
Thanks for that. If I could, Vladimir, is it okay if I interject a moment?
Sure.
Yeah, Patrick, thanks for that comment. I think that actually pulls on the thread of one of the things Vladimir had been asking about. And if I understand your answer correctly, at least for some signatures, there's a significant trade-off between polarization and energy. That is, if you could have, you know, a 3TeV machine with polarization, it would have similar utility to, I think you said, a 10TeV machine without. So that's a really important thing to come out of this discussion. I think that as far as cost goes, you know, to some extent, the muon collider has R&D that's needed. The accelerator Frontier 6 technologies certainly are in R&D stage at this point. So it's difficult to quantify exact costs. But certainly it's very important for us to be guided by the energy and theory frontiers on those kinds of trade-offs, right? That can really influence what kind of R&D is needed on the accelerators.
Yeah, just to follow up one quick comment. I mean, this comes back to the comment that Michael Peskin made and Lian Tao. And I mean, it really depends upon what physics targets you're interested in, because for the case of it, if the Higgs was the holy grail and that's what we wanted to, we could do this trade-off of, if you give me click polarization 3TeV versus 10TeV mu plus mu minus, then for Higgs physics in terms of most Higgs properties, I'm going to say that's great. But I think if you ask any physicist that's interested in BSM physics beyond just Higgs physics, all of us would say give us the 10TeV muon collider because we want the energy reach for new states. But I mean, so this is the trade-off, and that we can explore. We just need more conversations about, if you give me this trade-off, what will you get, and vice versa.
Okay, we have Manuel and then Roman.
Yes, my comment is very, very basic comment in reference to the gamma-gamma. I seem to remember when looking at it, that it has, among all of these machines, it was perhaps one of the least expensive and one that required the least R&D. So I hope that Michael Peskin will include it. Plus it has inherent polarization, I mean, polarization already embedded. So I hope that it will be included in the theoretical study by Michael Peskin.
Michael, can you comment? Okay.
I'm not sure he is connected any longer.
He is connected. He's muted.
Excuse me, I was muted. There actually is some new thinking about gamma-gamma that's being done at Slack, in particular by Tim Barklow and Zhirong Huang. And it's not quite ready for prime time, but it's coming soon. So you'll see it. It's Nimbus.
Okay. Sounds interesting. Roman, please.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for this interesting discussion that I follow with a really great interest. Concerning polarization, let me add another basic consideration that polarization can also match up for missing luminosity. We have the famous SLC lab example where not for all quantities, but for quite a few quantities, lab had much higher luminosity, but SLC was better because it had luminosity. And this was roughly a factor of 30. Depends a bit on if you have a chiral sensitive observable, then you can do miracles with luminosity, right? So this midwest polarization, but not miracles, but you can really do a lot of things. And also our exercise we did for the European strategy showed that there are a number of observables where, for example, the ILC has nothing to envy the FCC, even if the FCC has, I don't know how, Terra, Kent, Beta, Zets, but you are not so far from it. So that's something you should keep in mind as well. So.
Is there some magic formula? I remember, for example, for each.
Yeah, it's a
magic formula.
P over, it's roughly, I can't dig it out. There's a, mm-hmm. You can translate this in terms of analysis power where,
yeah.
I have it somewhere in one of my notes. I can send it to you. It's a bit unorthodox, but I call it analysis power where you can really see that how the polarization folds in. I can dig it out. It's a quite trivial formula, which you can look up in every textbook, yeah.
But at the same center of mass energy, with and without polarization, you could compare very very favorably that way. But to compare at 10 TeV muon collider with a 3TeV polarized electron positron machine, it's going to be a little bit tougher. You'd have to pick specific cross sections, I suppose, right?
Yeah, sure. That's, and with energy, I'm not so sure how you can compensate, maybe because you can switch off cross sections and have then a pure, you can switch off backgrounds and then have a purer sample. Honestly, I never thought about really how you can match up for energy, but for luminosity, for sure. Yeah, there I'm sure. Because this is also true. If you have polarization, you can purify your samples. You can switch up undesired backgrounds, and then you have a very much, much easier interpretation of your samples, which is also a big advantage. But okay, I will. This was just my two pennies to consider as well. So thanks. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Eric, please.
Yes, I'd just like to address a comment that Lan Tao made about concepts for 10TeV electron positron colliders seem to be lacking. And I think that's one place where plasmas could play a role. The whole advantage of plasma-based system is incredibly high gradients, which implies it's easier to get very high energies. That another intrinsic advantage of plasmas is the short bunch duration, which leads to reduced beam drawing, implying a higher charge per bunch, higher luminosity. But I think on paper, the studies we've done so far, which is really based on just our knowledge and understanding of the plasma LINAC, we do have designs, because we're only considering the physics of the LINAC, examples that were presented by Cameron in the table that would reach 10 TeV for electron positron collider. And again, a lot more needs to be done in terms of an integrated design, in particular the beam delivery system. At least conceptually, reaching high energies in a relatively compact LINAC plasmas do have an advantage. Positrons are a little more difficult for reasons that we don't have time to get into, but in principle, positrons can be accelerated as well. But electrons appear to be much easier. And again, this raises the question about gamma-gamma collider, which has already been mentioned. It would be a simpler option even for a plasma-based system. But the 10 TeV range does seem, at least on paper, to be something that is within reach with the plasma system.
I would probably recommend here, sort of, to again submit a proposal for this for such machine to Thomas. Maybe write a preprint. So because that's exactly what Lan Tao was Patrick were talking. So when they see something what actually can be done, what range of energies, luminosities, I'm sure that people will get more excited and potentially do specific studies. Yeah. So but we it has to be both ways. So it's not just sort of serious sort of predicting what kind of colliders could be built. I think it should be both ways. Yes. So,
but what I hear from Patrick Meade and Lan Tao that the theorists in general kind of don't want to invest too much effort into things which are prohibited by other reasons. For example, like cost. I believe a community is shocked by the cost of 3TeV click, which is in the range of $20 billion European accounting. So, and when we bring options for 10 TeV electron positron colliders, linear ones, I believe we need to convince people that we new approach is better in terms of dollars per TV or something like that. Hmm. Now, Cameron, I think you have your hand raised.
Yeah, thanks, Vladimir. So, Dmitry, thanks for that comment. So, as Thomas noted in his talk, the AF6 groups have worked and submitted coordinated examples, and to try to limit the number of cases that need to be considered, they have coordinated the parameter table. So these are technologies on which there is significant R&D to be done yet. And so there is a parameter set for 1 TeV, for 3 TeV, for 15 TeV. and that essentially spans the structure wake field, laser wake field, plasma wake field. And so there's a slight range in the parameters, but they've all been targeted to the same energies and luminosities. And so that's part of what we wanted to bring up today is that, you know, you're right, as of the last snowmass, those had not been discussed. And so based on the community interest that we heard from Energy and Theory Frontiers, and based on the great work that the Muon Forum and others have done in that area, those tables are ready. And we're ready to discuss with you what further is needed to allow calculations. And in particular, hopefully, you know, these are R&D concepts at this point. So they are not TDRs or even CDRs. But it would be nice to understand the commonalities, i.e. an electron looks like a muon, the differences, polarization could be important, and the potential for things like gamma-gamma at a high level.
Last question to Cameron, Eric, or whatever, all plasma proponents. Yesterday, Pushpa has shown that she has only 7 kilometers of distance on Fermilab site. And if you go with traditional collider designs, final focus system takes 3 to 4 kilometers out of 7. And of course, you guys are talking for a long time that plasma focusing, kind of super strong plasma focusing, can solve many, many problems. Is consideration of this super short focus in plasma lenses for colliders being part of any planning of R&D, DOE map or whatever? What can you say about that thing?
So maybe I can start to answer that, and then I'll ask if Spencer or Carl or Eric are connected, I'll ask them to comment also. So I know that I went by it quickly, but in my slides, you'll find that sequence of options for potential use in that case of an ILC facility, but it's similar for a Fermilab site filler type option. So the structure gets you part of it, but as Vladimir points out, the focusing is a big part of it. So beam delivery for these colliders is also a topic of R&D. These colliders will position you in the quantum beam Stirling regime, which has important advantages in improving the interaction and potentially reducing wall plug required. But yes, plasma lenses are absolutely part of the design strategy. And that was essentially the last line in my table. And it's the combination of plasma focusing for the beam delivery and for interstage coupling that really gets you to the high geometric gradients over the whole LINAC. And could be used in a machine like a Fermilab site filler.
In that case, even 1 TV per kilometer gives you 7 TV center of mass on Fermilab site, roughly speaking, right?
Yes.
Do these plasma lenses work both for the electron beam focusing and also the positron? Are there issues there?
There are issues. You do need different designs, but there are plasma structures that are focusing for positrons. I flashed by one very quickly. There is a concept for using a plasma column rather than a large contiguous plasma that, for example, creates a focusing region for positrons that could be used.
If I could add to some of those general comments. As I mentioned previously, most of our research.
I don't know.
Okay, look, why not? We only have a few minutes left here, so we have two hands up. So Roman was
first. Yeah. I have a maybe stupid question, but how much would such a plasma or all these efforts benefit from the fact that, let's say, a facility would be already there in which at a later stage you could be then embed your device, I mean, as an upgrade, not as a new device, but really as an upgrade, because you need to also get the physicists and us, the experimentalists, and all you need to get us going with a facility that runs, and that when we go and then we go above 1 TeV and you name it, so it's to have not a step function, but you have to start somewhere, right? So that you
go that later. We have this 10TV as an exciting upgrade option so that you have really a facility, a physicist community that actively analyzes the data, the plus and minus data in that point. So I think some, you said it, I think to put this in a broader context, I think this is important.
I fully agree. Yeah. And that was exactly the intent of showing that table, starting from a near-term facility, such as an ILC or a site filler, and then being able to develop in that. I fully agree that that's extremely important.
Yeah. Yeah.
Spencer?
Right. Yeah. On the topic of plasma lenses, this is something that's important for, you know, making full use of a high energy plasma driven collider. It's also something that, if we can demonstrate that it works, could be of advantage to a conventional collider, because in a sense, the BDS, the beam delivery system, is separate from the accelerator. So at FACET, we have ongoing work on plasma lenses, looking at trying to approach the Ouida limit in terms of the focusing strength and producing small spots. At Berkeley, they for a long time have been looking at the active plasma lens and using that for their interstage coupling. So it's something that we're pushing on pretty hard, and it's something that the whole accelerator community can benefit from, not just advanced accelerators, for as in terms of getting high luminosity machines at better luminosity per power.
I think that's an excellent point. It sort of draws on something that I mentioned briefly, which is that we should think of advanced accelerators not just as full colliders, but as potential components, whether it be focusing or injectors or other systems.
Yep.
Okay, look, we are at 4:30, so that was planned end of our meeting. So I would like to thank everyone who participated, especially the speakers, and of course, many of us who asked questions and participated in the discussions. So all talks, by the way, on the agenda. So if you have questions or further comments, yes, so you can always connect to the speakers. But with that, I think we reached the end of the session. So thank you. Stay healthy. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.